make kickbacks or payoffs to government officials. But that doesn't say anything about business executives, individuals, or key people in other companies who make decisions about selecting your product versus somebody else. Nonetheless, we decided that we would eliminate that activity, and we had this is a $70 million company, $72 million. We had identified about $12 million of kickbacks, sales that were involved with kickbacks and payoffs, and we decided to eliminate that. And most of them were in Black Africa, and I remember. Well, there's a huge textile segment, by the way, mainly run by Chinese who own the mills. And many of these countries prohibit any the investors from taking money out of the country. So the investors' response to that is to get the suppliers to raise the prices and then get a pickback, and they deposit the money in Switzerland. Well, we decided we weren't going to do any of that. We didn't want to be involved in that. And it took them about 6 months to take the business away from us and find other suppliers who would continue the kickbacks and payoffs. Well, that was devastating because we lost $12 million of $70 million of sales. I remember there was a gentleman who was one of our distributors in Africa, and I met with him, and he thought I was insane when I told him we weren't going to give him a very high distributor commission so that he could make these kickbacks and payoffs. He said, Mr. Sergani, he said, you ever been to Africa? I said, no, I haven't. He said, well, let me tell you what happened to me last year as your distributor. He said, I went to Africa, and he said, I had a driver in a car. We went out to the textile mill in the country. Coming back, a band of robbers stopped us, beat and shot my driver and killed him. And seriously beat me and left me in a ditch to die. He said, fortunately, an army truck came along, saw me in the ditch and the driver dead, and took me to a hospital, and the German consulate was able to have me taken back to Germany. Now, do you think I deserve a 12% commission or not? Our normal commission was 3 or 4. Maybe 5 or 6, but he was getting 12, which he used for facilitating payments. He said, or would you like to go and sell the chemicals yourself? So, nonetheless, we cut his commission. We lost all of his business, and he went to somebody else. And it has a serious impact on the company. And as a matter of fact, there was an interesting side on that, and that side was that the employees of the company, since we had to have a cutback, threatened to sue us because we followed American law and not German law, and as a result of that stupidity, as they said, they were being forced out of work. And so it was an interesting experience from that standpoint. And you know, I think I'm not quite sure what I think about that. But I know in various parts of the world it's very difficult to do anything without facilitating payments of some kind. And the government recognizes that too, because, for instance, in the law, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, they clearly say that minor facilitating payments are all right. But they don't define what minor is. But, for instance, if you're in Indonesia and you need to get a phone installed in less than a year, you've got to make a facilitating payment. Or you need to get something taken off the dock and shipped to your factory. Well, the government recognizes that, and they say that's okay. But mainly what the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was designed to do was to prevent payments from reaching government officials and so forth. So, I mean, that whole area is quite a mess. And Diamant had a French subsidiary that sold into the same Black Africa and the same other places. It's illegal to make such payments in France. And they had some of the same customers, and they were not making payments. So, very difficult problem, but nonetheless, the amount we bought, because they made natural chemicals from human hair, seaweed, guar, and they had a material which was called cassia, which was a plant in India, which was these are thickeners. They basic business was they made thickeners for the food, drug, and pharmaceutical industry and textile industry. They were the largest supplier of thickeners to the textile industry, which when you do very fine quality fabrics, you have to carefully control the distribution of the dyes, and that's a result of the thickness of the fluid that the dye is in, which you adjust by putting a thickener in of some kind. That is as much as I know about dyeing textile fabrics. But their customers were all the very high-end houses and the very complicated fabrics. As a matter of fact, we are today in Sojeni Investment Partners bidding on a company that's a division of Calco, which was bought by Monsanto, which makes alginates, which come from seaweed, and are thickeners for food products. So we had that same business. I bought that because I thought the millennium, in the new millennium, natural chemicals would have greater potential than petrochemicals. Interesting company. I thought had great potential. I might add that they also made a product called cysteine or cystine, which was extracting protein from human hair. Mm-hmm. And the plant was located near Dachau. And every time I drove down Dachau, Strausa, and I would have these, to get to the plant, I had these pictures of all these people in the concentration camp with shaved heads. And here we were making these chemicals from human hair. So, but it turns out that the best place to extract the chemicals, the proteins, from human hair are in the Orient, because that wonderful shine you see the Oriental hair, whether it's Japanese, Chinese, or Indian, comes from the fact that they have about 50% more protein in their hair than Caucasians do. So we built a plant in India to do the extraction from the hair, and the Indians go to shrines and have their hair cut, and the people who run the shrines sell the hair to people who make chemicals out of it. In China, it was the same thing. And these materials are used widely, the cysteine and cystine, widely in medicines in Europe, cough syrups. But the most interesting part is they are now finding their way into your vitamin supplements and into drugs for fighting cancer and so forth. Cysteine is the most powerful antioxidant that anybody knows about, and it's a natural material. And so if you pick up an antioxidant vitamin formula, the ones who are really state-of-the-art will have some of that in them. You can go down to General Nutrition here and you can buy a box of tablets of cysteine. And so I think it's going to, as people understand it, it's going to play a very important role in food and drugs and so forth. And it was
we're becoming cannibals.
Right. It was a product I thought was very interesting, and I am sure will grow, and it's now a part of a lot of vitamin packages. Not that that's a big use at the moment, but it does have an effect, and antioxidants have been shown significant in reducing cancer and reducing heart disease. At the same time, we bought Riley Whiteman, which was a small company, and it was located in Conshohocken in Philadelphia. It had been in the business for 100 years, and the plant looked like it had been there for 100 years and did not have anything done to it in a long time. Although they had built a new water treating facility, it sat right on the Schuylkill River, and occasionally the river would rise and wash right through the plant. So it really was right down in there on the river. We decided to shut that plant down and move the production to our plant in Charlotte, and And so we did that.
So what were you really buying then? Customers or?
We were buying customers and product line. Mm-hmm. And so what that did to us then was places where we had these five acquisitions and had a company now that was $250 million. But it was highly leveraged. And in a period where, you know, there were modest downturns, the company was very difficult to operate. In retrospect, not doing a public offering was probably a mistake. Things went on then, and the company continued to grow, although not as rapidly, and didn't make the improvements as rapidly that we thought we could. It was more difficult to do than you anticipate, and I think that's always true. In 1996, the investors, Joseph Littlejohn and Levy Fund, had decided that they wanted to sell the company, not go public, and realize any gains they had, and they wanted to start to package the company for sale. And they decided that one way of doing that was to cut the overhead costs and so forth. Both Rulo and I were working in the company. We were not going to make any more acquisitions. And they thought and said, well, you know, one of you guys ought to leave the payroll because the company isn't going to change. We're going to operate this way. And one of you is working on acquisitions and the other one is working on operations. And we're paying you $400,000 or $500,000 a year and so forth. I might say when we started with them, we each started with $75,000 that we were drawing. I gave all of that to Fred because he needed it. Then it went up to, I think, $125,000 each, and Fred wound up taking $175,000, and I took $75,000, and so on it went because I had the retirement money to help fund my living. Eventually, it all equalized, and he paid me back all the difference and so forth. But I tell you that just to tell you that it is not easy because you don't have somebody who's coming in and giving you a lot of money. Ultimately, we were each making about $400,000 when the company was up around $300 million. So the decision was made they were going to sell it. And so initially they wanted me to stay because they felt that I might be able to do a better job selling the company. Then eventually they decided that Fred ought to stay and I ought to leave. I remained on the board, obviously to watch my investment and so forth.
How was the investment end of it set up?
We negotiated, which turned out to be a very good deal, in the standpoint that we made investments side by side with them. Now, you have to understand that these investment houses, these funds, are driven by returns. So they make their money when the returns on the money for the pension funds that give them money are at a certain level. And most of them get 20%, and they get a 1% or 2% management fee. For instance, if they have $1 billion, they would get probably a 20% carried interest once they achieve a certain return, but they take 1% or 2% as a management fee. And the way it works, it's very interesting. It took a while to understand this. The way it works is, usually, all the money they've taken as management fees gets paid out of any profits back to the investors. Then the investors get a return, usually 10 to 11% before anybody gets anything. And then the money that's there beyond that gets split probably 80-20. And that was a deal. We had a deal similar to that. It was structured slightly different.
Split 80-20 between who and who?
Between Joseph Littlejohn and Levy and the California pension funds. Okay. Now, we were inserting ourselves in that. None of these funds, none of these investment banking or funds have management. So they either have management in the company, or they don't, or they have to have people like us, like the Freedom Group. And so they were paying our expenses and salaries, and we were managing Freedom Chemical Company. And for that, the Freedom Group got 20% of any profits. In addition, the management below us got 5%. So, and then we bought 3% of the equity side by side with the fund. So the management group had about 28% of the company. The people, Joseph Littlejohn and Levy, were representing had 72%. And then Joseph Littlejohn and Levy took their cut out of that. To ensure a minimum return, and this was 11%, 85% of the money put in was put in as a preferred stock with a dividend of 11%. 15% was put in as equity, as common stock. They had invested, and the normal thing is you'd like 25%, put in as equity. So we had spent about $175 million, and we should have put in $45 to $50 million, but they had put less in. We had put about $35 in. And we were stretched really to the limit financially. The reason they like to put, to minimize the equity, is they get a higher return if they can put, the ultimate is putting no equity, which they did in the last two transactions. I was explaining this to a young investment banker the other day, that she wanted to put so little equity in the deal, and I said to her, well, let's go to the ultimate. I mean, let's do it with just a dollar from you and a dollar from me, and our returns will be infinite if we make anything at all. So now we're down to the point where they want to sell. The banks are not happy because we're just on the ragged edge of meeting the ratios that are in our loan agreements. As a matter of fact, at one point we did go into default on our loan agreements. It wasn't a serious default. All payments were made, but the ratios were off. And so our friends in New York, who are having their own problems, it's just Littlejohn and Levy is a small partnership with four partners, and Yvonne Marsh is in a disagreement, Yvonne Cliff is in a disagreement with her, with them, and they ask her to leave. And that's a very contentious thing. Affects us because she's our contact partner. Then two of the other two partners leave, and the senior partner remains. And so there's a fair amount of turmoil there. They then decide that they want to refinance the company, and they're going to do a high-yield offering and infuse additional equity into the company. And the high yield offering would be done to replace the bank debt, because in a high yield bond issue, you just pay interest charges and not principal. And that would free up money to do other things. However, they had just made the decision that they wanted to sell. Well, it turns out that the senior partner, he didn't know whether he wanted to sell or stay. And they were asking for a very high price for the company, and they hadn't gotten any offers. We retained Wertheim Schroeder, any offers that were even close to what they wanted. And I had offered to buy the company at a certain price, and they said it was too low. So they had high aspirations. They weren't getting them, and they were torn between staying and letting the earnings improve or getting out. They did the high yield offering. The part that was interesting was they wanted to infuse $10 million of equity. And how they did that, of course, was critical to the management investors. I had just finished saying that we had 85% preferred stock and 15% common. And so at a board meeting, I said, well, if you really think we need the equity at this point, that's okay. I presume we're going to put it in at 85 preferred, 15 common. The answer was, well, we haven't decided that yet. All right. And I said, the contract calls for hiring an investment banker for an appraisal. He said, yes, we've hired an investment banker. It's fine. And when will we get his report so we know what the company's worth? Because that's going to be the price that we offer the stock at. The next board meeting. So the next board meeting, we show up, and the investment banker's been fired. And they've done their own evaluation of the company. And they're going to put in 100% of the money in common stock. This is a favorite technique of these people. You know, get the management to work for you for 5 years and then take their money. And so I was sitting there and I said, let me understand this. I said, we've put $35 million into the company. 85% is in preferred stock. So we have about $5 million in common stock. And you want to put $10 million more into common stock. And I think I just lost two-thirds of my ownership. I said, well, you can invest side by side with us. I said, well, I don't have any problem if we have a realistic price for the stock. I don't have any problem if we put it in the same ratio we've always put it in, 85-15. I said, we just gave options to the management at $250 a share, and you want to put your money in at $100 a share. And I think you're trying to steal two-thirds of the management share of the company. Now, meanwhile, they're out in the high yield, and of course the people in the high yield, they're going to buy these bonds, they immediately pick that up. And they say, well, is management going to be happy about this? And the answer to that is, no, the management's not going to be happy about it. Now, I've left the company and started Sogani Investment Partners. And so I said to them, well, maybe we should clarify where we are. You may think that I fell off a turnip truck. And I'm a rube or farmer, I said. But the turnip truck was in Brooklyn. I said, now, just to make myself perfectly clear, I said, you either accommodate the management so that the management comes out owning 28% of this company, or I will sue you, stop the bond offering, and destroy the company and lose the $3 million I have invested, but I won't let you steal it from me. So what are you getting excited about? I said, I'm not excited. It's just a simple principle. You try to steal my money, you're going to war. And I said, if you think I'm kidding, you ask your lawyers at Skadden Arps to call my lawyers in Philadelphia to see whether or not we're ready to file a lawsuit tomorrow morning in New York City, New York courts, New York State, to stop you from doing what you're doing. And I don't care whether I destroy the company or not, or whether I lose my money. But you'll never steal my money. We have to work this out in some way. Well, yes, that's fine. We will. And we can. But don't think you can steal my money or the management's money, because you're not going to be able to do that. Well, we did work it out. They made loans available to the management so that everybody's share stayed constant. And when the company, we hired a new investment banker who seemed to understand the value of the company, J.P. Morgan. They were excellent. They went out and they got 26 bids for the company. They bid individual pieces, because we still have it set up in individual companies, or in its entirety. And in its entirety, the bids were in the $370 million range. Individual pieces, they came out over $400. Again, our partners didn't want to take the risk of being left with a piece. So they accepted B.F. Goodrich's bid for $375 million, I think it was. $372 million. Keep in mind, we had paid $175 million. So in the end, considering that we had $45 million of equity, and when it was just in the last $10 million for a year, everybody who invested made $4 per dollar. We got our carried interest, and I don't remember exactly how much the management group made, but it was in total probably 28% of whatever was there. It was probably close to $40 million that was split amongst the management group. So everything worked out well, and everybody made a lot of money, and they were happy, and you know, we still talk to each other today and talk about all's well, you know, that ends well. But when there's a dollar to split, you better be well prepared or you wind up with crumbs.
Yeah.
And at the final settlement of this, I had my open heart surgery. I was being represented by Joe Giacomini of Dilworth, and we had a settlement sheet dividing up the final money. And I said to Joe, here are my instructions. You go to New York, and you see this amount here that says I get. Don't sign anything until I get exactly that amount. I am not interested in any adjustments. So sure enough, they go in, and since they put the settlement sheet out, they've uncovered some additional costs and other things, and you know, several million dollars more that has to be taken off in the money. And so Joe said, gee, I'm sorry. I'm under the instructions that that's the amount of money I have to bring home, and we're not signing anything until we bring home that money. So right down to the bitter end, trying to take as much as they can. Now, that's not everyone, but it just happens to be the people that we were dealing with in this regard. And it's considered to be, when you hear people talk about it, fair game. And, of course, that's not the way I ever have done business. And so it's kind of a rude awakening for me. And from the standpoint that in our industry, in our business life, I have never seen that kind of behavior, and so I learned a lot. I made a lot of money. I learned a lot, and now we're on to something else. You know, over the period of time that we're involved, six years, I guess, 7 years before we finally split the money up, a little bit less than that. I learned a lot of different things about how you run a business when you're short on cash and don't infuse much money in, and so forth. So I learned a great many things that are different than running a big corporation. So I found it a very useful and valuable experience, and hope to apply much of what I've learned here again. So that's... That's the Freedom Chemical experience. And so now we've moved on to Sorgenia Investment Partners. But very, very interesting, very challenging. There were periods of time in that business when, as I've said, I think before, the cash was so short that on Friday afternoon we were sitting in the headquarters releasing checks one at a time. And that's the difference between running a big corporation and running a leveraged buyout.
Let me just ask you a couple of things, Hal. One is take something like Hilton Davis. That the people in that plant and operation, they're bought, they're sold, they're bought,
yeah.
They're sold. What does that, isn't that very destructive to...
Yeah.
Morale?
It is. It's a very demoralizing experience. The people don't feel nobody cares about them. They don't feel they have any say. And this is one of the great problems in American industry today. And it's sooner or later it will come home to roost. And I've talked a little bit about that in previous comments I've made. Employees are not considered stakeholders. And I believe people who understand that, recognize that, change it, will get super productivity out of their employees, rather than an attitude that says, you know, nobody really cares about me. It's very hard to maintain morale in a situation when people are bored and sold, or they feel they're being treated like cattle, and in many cases they are. And in some cases, the management doesn't really care at all what happens to them. For instance, Anarcho Chemical was just sold for $7 billion, and I was concerned about certain things that were happening in terms of benefits and so forth for myself and for others. And I called and I asked the head of human resources, I said to him, who is protecting the employees' interests? Who cares about what happens to the employees? And he said, you know the answer to that. And I said, what is the answer to that? He said, no one. And, you know, so I'm saying, when we sold to Goodrich, and most big companies do this, I mean, you know, it's the exception where I said before, they don't care. That's not true for most. I'm saying most companies care. And most businesses that you buy, the seller, as we did with Goodrich, insist that the employees' benefits are at least as good, if not better, in other words. But sometimes nobody specifies that. And so companies come in and they feel they have the ability to reduce benefits, reduce costs that way by decreasing the benefits to employees. So at least when we sold Freedom, we insisted that they'd be maintained, and when we bought it from Cyanamid, the benefits we put in were actually better than Cyanamid's at Freedom. So, but you're absolutely right, it's a tremendous negative, and it takes a considerable period of time to regenerate morale, dedication, and loyalty. Loyalty is there any loyalty today in business? I mean, I've discussed this before, I think, earlier in the write-ups. It used to be that you started with a company, you stayed with a company, you had a career with a company, you worked there, your father probably worked there before you, and today none of that's true. People come to work for a company, don't really expect to stay, don't really expect to be there. They feel free, no obligation, no loyalty to the company. That's all part of this turmoil that's created.
Does I mean, is employee stock ownership a kind of a real tool in this?
I think ultimately it could be, and again, as I said before, the second part of this is the people who represent the investments of the employees themselves who are driving this turmoil. I mean, who are these investors demanding these returns? The pension funds. And who do they represent? So, you know what I'm saying? The European system is different. And the employees are much more stakeholders in the European situation because the unions and the pension boards have a lot more to say about what happens in the company. Obviously, but things are not great in Europe from the standpoint of their competitiveness.
Yeah.
And so forth. So I guess what you have to say is this, that making a highly competitive enterprise in a global economy is the best protection that you can give people. Now, if you can do that in as humane a way as possible, then it's a good thing. And so the question is, how do you manage in a way that considers the employees but still creates a highly efficient and effective company? You know, there's been a lot of dialogue over the years recently. The Jesuits are very much into this kind of thing, and what are the obligations of management and so on and so forth. And I've given talks on this subject. there was a recent announcement. I guess there was a piece, an op-ed piece, I think, in Chemical Processing about some of the comments I had made in this area. And recently, Ernie Davenport was singled out as saying that he needed to cut a considerable amount of the workforce, but that he was committed to doing it through natural attrition and early retirements and so forth. Those are things that you can easily do if you try to balance the equation. So the sensitivity to that is important. The creativity that's necessary to effectively do that, and taking the time to consider it. For instance, when you hit downturns, one way of approaching that is to everybody reduce their hours by a certain amount, rather than just letting go of people. When you hire, one way of doing that is to never hire the full complement of what you need, but to hire some portion of it as contract and whatnot. And a lot of people don't like that or consider that, but they think you're doing it to save money. But really, what you may be doing is not so much to save money, but to stabilize the workforce so that you don't have to lay people off when bad times come. So I'm saying, is that ingrained in management? Do they consider that? Is it an important part of management thought and consideration? The answer to that is in a few special companies, yes, but not very many.
Let me ask you another question. The sort of sequence of things that you were doing at Freedom, working with the investor group, having the special expertise, if you look broad gauge across the chemical process industries, how many people are there out there doing the sort of thing you were doing?
Well, there's a handful, and there's probably 10 or less. The ultimate is, of course, was Gordon Kane and John Huntsman. They built great dynasties, and as I've said before, Gordon did it at a different time. There are others. George Harris did very well. There's a group that two or three fellows that came out of Exxon. There's a group of a senior executive out of Morton Thiokol. I think he calls his group the Sovereign Group. So there's less than 10.
And you guys run across each other all?
Cy Baldwin, who did a wonderful job with Cambrex. Now there's the ultimate success case, something that I would like to do, you see. Because if you're able to do what Cy did, then you can you can have employee involvement and do the kinds of management things that you want to do. But ultimately, you see, you have to. The conclusion I've come to is, when you're working for the LBO people, the leverage buyout people, you should probably go public early, and in that way, the management maintains some control, because when the leverage buyout people want to get out, they can get out without selling the company as a whole. If you wait until it's too late, let's say their absolute drop-dead date is 7 years, and you don't go public until you're 6 years, they won't go public, or you don't propose going public, because they want to get out in 7 years. And I discussed a little bit of this earlier, so that's another thing I learned. It was a mistake not taking Freedom public, because if we had taken Freedom public, we would still be there. The investors would be gone. The management would have 25% of the company, and we would run it in a way where the employees were an important part of it.
Yeah, and then you could grow.
Yeah.
Yes. When you say the investors want to get out, what's magic about 7 years?
Seven is very long. most of them have a maximum five-year horizon and a preference for three. And the reason is that is if you put in a dollar now and you let it sit there, see, they're all driven by returns. I come to you, who are the head of the state of Florida pension fund, and I say, give me $500 or $200 or $100 million, whatever, and I'll give it back to you with a 35% return. If you figure that out, what you have to do to make 35% after 7 years, it's enormous. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you can't possibly accomplish. So time is a deadly enemy of return. And so they're driven to put the minimum equity in because that maximizes return and achieve absolute and total withdrawal as quickly as possible.
So they really are depending on creative entrepreneurial energy in small groups to deliver that return.
And I'm saying, if you go public at the end of 5 years, you can't sell it. The shareholders can't sell any stocks, so they can't do anything because nobody will buy it if you're bailing out. So they they're restricted, as I said before, for 6, 12, 18 months, 12 I think, before they can sell something. So then they sell, and they probably can only sell 20%. And so you see, it's now a long process, and their returns are low. As a matter of fact, when we negotiate with them, we say, what does it mean? When do we calculate your return? What does it mean? Because I'm saying, if you just think about it for a minute, what does it mean? When we go public, there's a value established for your shares. Is that when we calculate return? Some people that you talk to say, hell no. When I sell my last share is when we calculate your split. Well, of course, if you don't work with ethical people, they can sell everything if you let your contract be based on that. They can sell everything except a small percentage. And you'll never get anything for your troubles if it's based on their return. And then you have other people that say, well, it's reasonable. We'll calculate it when we go public, even though we can't dispose of the stock. Other people would argue, well, suppose over the next 3 years the stock goes down. You've taken your money. So it's not a simple thing, and it's an interesting part of the negotiation. And we go through it all the time. And they're all different. But most would say, what I've gotten out, you get your money and not before. And many times that leads you to a sale of 100% of the enterprise rather than going public. The best alternative for a leveraged investor is a sale of the enterprise, not a public offering. Because he gets out in total.
Yeah, but that's against your interests in terms of what you personally want.
What I will accomplish.
So what you're bringing to the table this time around is some learning in that territory, plus a bigger nut, and therefore more voice,
and with the understanding that I'm going to try to go public as quickly as we can.
Okay, should be interesting. Okay. Should we go to other territory then?
Yeah.
Should we take a minute break here?